Cut, a proud member of the Pitcherless Podcast. I'm Pete Ball, joined as always by Chad Young. Please consider following the show at Keep or Cut on Twitter, especially during the offseason, because that's when so many of, you know, what our show has to offer will help you with is during your offseason decisions. Please follow Chad at Chad Young, and you can follow me at Pete B. Baseball. Chad, we're at episode 76. I don't know if there are any athletes that are numbered 76 in MLB because I'm terrible with numbers. But with all that said, what's going on, Chad?
Yeah, I'm looking up 76 right now. There are not many. The all-time war leader on Baseball Reference among players. I discovered now, you can look this up. You can go, there's a jersey number lookup thing. MLB players who wore a number at Baseball Reference that you can sort by years they wore it as well as career war. And Jose Iglesias with 12 war is the best player to ever wear number 76, but he only wore it for 1 year. So I'm not sure that really counts. There is no player in Major League history who has worn it for more than 3 years. And the player who wore it for 3 years is a Boston Red Sox, Hector Velasquez.
Yeah, all right. Kind of like a tweener sparp there. I think we got to give it to Jesus Sanchez. I see him right below Velasquez on that list, and he's a current player who let me down in the Keeper Cut Otney League. So this is the Jesus Sanchez episode.
Sure. Why not? At least in a few years, there's a possibility that will look good. Probably not.
Sure. Yeah, but maybe. Yeah. He's got a lot of pop. So anyway, we were trying to figure out what we were going to talk about this week. And there's just so many players out there right now that look like they're going to be hard to value for next season. Now, we know you're in your championships or your championships just wrapped up, but there's not much more to be said left for this season, especially for keeper leagues and Otney leagues and dynasty leagues and all that stuff that we like to cover. So we're thinking about players who I have no idea where their ADP is going to end up next year. I have no idea how different sites are going to rank them. I think these are the types of guys who, like, you know, ESPN might have 47th overall and then CBS has them 208th overall. They're just going to be the place. And Chad, we came up with this list, and looking at this list, it's making me a little sad because I rostered a lot of these guys, and for
so almost, many of them.
Yeah, almost all of them. It's like not a good thing that they were rostered, but I like the one that you have us starting off with here, even though, you know, most of the season was missed due to injuries. There's a lot of concern here with Chris Bryant. So what are your thoughts on Bryant going into next season?
So the first thing that jumped out at me, there's a couple of stats on Chris Bryant that stand out. The one is he had something like 100 and some odd home plate appearances and did not hit a single home run at Coors Field, which is like, I don't know. He had 111 home plate appearances with zero home runs. Zero. I don't even understand how that's possible. And, you know, I picked him up in that Fangraph staff league that you and I play in, the Otto New League, because we wanted him. Niv was my co-manager in that. Niv and I picked him up as our, like, as a guy for Otto New Prestige League, because we were like, he plays three positions. He's going to hit 40 home runs playing at Coors. This is going to be incredible. No. None. Not one at Coors. The other stat that jumped out at me, which I was fully unaware of until I looked at his page, was he had a 370 WOBA. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with WOBA, a 370 WOBA, like, that's really good. That's one of the better. I mean, he didn't have very many plate appearances. He only had like 180 plate appearances or something like that. But if you go look at the major league leaders in WOBA, there are a total of 14 players qualified for the batting title with a 370 or better WOBA. So Bryant had that slow start. He hit no home runs at Coors, but his overall line is really good. And then he's been injured a ton because he's only, like I said, only had 181 plate appearances. So he's really tough to evaluate because the overall performance was actually quite good. It was not shaped anything like what we expected, right? I mean, a 306 batting average with no home runs at Coors. Like, I don't know. I'm having a really tough time trying to figure out, like, do I just throw this season out? And I've done that to him before, right? In 2020, in the shortened season, he was terrible. And I was sort of like, probably he'll bounce back. And he did. And then this year, he's been even better than what he was last year. But I don't know if I should just ignore this season and just be like, it was weird. He's going to hit plenty of home runs at Coors. Or if I should be legitimately worried about his power performance moving forward.
Yeah, it's legit concerns. And, you know, you brought up the injuries and you can't talk about Chris Bryant without talking about the injuries. And they're
sure.
I mean, you don't want to see an injury anywhere, but his injuries are all in like areas that are really concerning. Right. He dealt with the shoulder a couple years ago, missed a ton of time for that. That's not something you want to see for power. And he's never been a guy who's posted like super impressive Statcast numbers. At least he hasn't been since like his rookie season. So I don't see that and get majorly concerned. But when you hear about the injuries and you see the dip in performance, that's where it begins to come up. There's been some talk, at least there was earlier in the week. And by earlier in the week, I mean like actually a couple days ago, that he might try to return in these last 11 games, which would be maybe affect his fantasy value like a tiny bit, not for good reasons, right? But for kind of like confirmation bias, if he comes back for the last series and hits two home runs, you know, there could be some momentum towards his draft stock next season. But when you say, Chad, like you're willing to throw out the season, I kind of agree with you, but when we say that, that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to rank that player the same we did. Like we'll throw out the season, but now we're a little bit more concerned because we're more removed from solid production. So if you just had to throw it out there, and obviously, you know, probably months from now, we're going to do a more concrete ranking. But like, where do you think you're going to feel comfortable taking Chris Bryant next year, knowing he plays a position that's kind of hard to find production at?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm trying to pull up some ADP data to see where he was going this year. And so this is NFBC ADP data, February 1st through the end of draft season, basically.
While you're pulling that up, Chad, yeah. I actually want to say, I don't think he's going to have third base eligibility next year. He has only played left field for all 30 games that he's played in, and he's DH'd 12 times. He's played 42 games, outfield for 30. DH for 12. So, whoa. If Chris Bryant's losing third base eligibility, that outfield's thin, but that's going to really hurt his value next year.
Yeah, that is definitely a big hit. And I don't know. It depends. That's one where like league format matters a lot. Like you're looking at like a standard Yahoo setup with three outfielders and two util. Outfield is deep. It's really deep. In Auto New, where you have five outfielders, that outfield eligibility is still pretty useful. Bryant this year, NFBC ADP in February and March was 78.42. So, you know, mid seventh round in a 12 teamer, early sixth round in a 15. I'm looking now and I'm sort of thinking I do think he bounces back in terms of number of games played, but I think you're looking at 100 and let's peg the over under at 135. Like, I don't think he's playing 150, and I don't think he'll play 100 again, but I don't think he's playing 150 either. So let's call it 135 games. Let's say that, you know, he falls back in line. Like last season, he had a 356 WOBA, bounced back, like I said, to 370 this year. Interestingly, Zips and Steamer still have rest of season projections up. And well, the counting stats don't mean anything because it's like no numbers there. The rates are still sort of what they project. And Zips projects a 376 WOBA and Steamer a 333. That's like the difference between one of the better hitters in baseball and being a completely average hitter. And so that's a huge range. And I was going to say, I think he ends up just below where he was in 2021. That was a 356. So, you know, let's say he ends up with maybe 25 to 30 home runs, a 260 average, 345, 350 on base, somewhere around that line. I'm not going to want to take him in the top 100. I think outside the top 100, you know, then you start getting into needs and we'll have to see how healthy he is and blah, 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 blah. Like a lot of new information will come out, but I think he's going to drop at least 3 to 4 rounds from where he was.
I agree with that analysis, and I think that's actually going to make me in on him. So I know I kind of keep flip-flopping here. It's like, oh, you know, he got bad injuries, but, you know, maybe people forget about him, and now I'm looking he's going to lose third base eligibility. But to put it kind of simply, Chris Bryant is only 30 years old. And with how much he lifts the ball, which is something I was just looking at, you know, career ground ball rate of just 36%. And otherwise he's hitting the ball in the air. Put that in cores. I feel like you can still get a lot of value there, assuming he is only like four rounds or more later than where he was going last year. So final thoughts, Chad, anything on Bryant? Do you think he's going to be in a lot of your rosters next year?
No, I don't. I think the final thing I'm going to throw out there is I just pulled up his Statcast data. He had a career low average exit velocity, a career low max exit velocity, the second lowest barrel rate of his career. That 2020, that awful 2020 season was the only one lower. Lowest hard hit rate of his season, of his career. He had the second lowest xWOBA of his career, again, behind that 2020 disaster. And so now I'm sort of revising down what I just said, where I said he could bounce back to 2021 levels, but a little bit lower. I think it's more like 2021 levels, but significantly lower. Like, I don't know, sure. Significantly seems like a weird word. I'm not saying he's going to be terrible, but I was saying he's going to fall 3 to 4 rounds. I think that's probably about where he'll fall from ADP. I don't think I would take him there. I think I'm actually going to want to sit outside the top 125, outside the top 130, and I'm just not sure he'll fall there.
Yeah, I think that's a safe space to be. If now, again, I'm thinking like, well, if he's actually in the top 120, maybe I won't have him. But I agree with it. I agree with the analysis. He's a guy who we're going to have to follow closely in the offseason, see how he's feeling, so on and so forth. And that actually has a lot in common with our next player, who's another player who is in a new location and I think was trying to live up to a contract, maybe similar to Bryant as well, for sure, who signed for a ton of money and has also dealt with a fair share of injuries. Now, his season hasn't been nearly as disappointing as Bryant's. He hasn't missed nearly as much time as Bryant. But that's Trevor Story, a guy who is a first-round pick. And if you've been playing fantasy baseball long enough, you remember that Trevor Story was a late first, early second-round pick for a couple of years there in Colorado. So what are we doing with Trevor Story next year, Chad? What'd you see this year? Are you concerned or maybe excited for his 2023 value?
Story, I'm more excited than concerned. I think he had a really rough start. And I do think it is possible that in that rough start, he was learning a new position. He was trying to your point, you know, live up to that contract, right? And from a fantasy perspective, he was very frustrating to roster early in the season. I mean, his March, April WRC plus was 69. Like that is low. It is not nice. And then he bounced back in May and was better, but then fell apart again in June, July. And finally in the second half of the season, just took off, was tearing the cover off the ball, doing everything you expect him to do, taking full advantage of that park, because that's a great park for him to hit in. And then he got hurt again. And it's just like, I was really hoping he would put on a solid end to the season. I will say I've got some personal tie-ups with this, because in League One, again, out of new League One, again, for an out of new Prestige League trade, I gave up Oscar Gonzalez, Taj Bradley, and Ezekiel Tovar for a $24 Trevor Story. And he was going to solidify my middle infield, give me a big bat down the stretch. Then he was injured at that time, but supposed to come back right away. And then he didn't. And he missed he basically missed the entire rest of the OPL season. And then when he did come back, he was awesome. And now he's hurt again. And I could really use him right now because I'm in a tight race. I am in a tight race. I can get those words out at the top of the standings. And at the time I made the trade, I thought a $24 Story, like, oh, he'll have a great second half and then he'll be a keeper at $24. And he had that great second half, kind of, but now he's hurt again. And so like, I was really thinking in my head, like, okay, if he finishes the season this strong, I'll feel good about him at $24 next year. And, you know, he's not going to do that now. And so you're looking at a guy who, like, at $24, I think is not far off from his auto new price. He might have been even a little higher in some cases. His average draft position for NFBC was 36th. Like, he was a third round pick. And in the second half of the season, that's what he's performed like. Right, his second half of the season, he has a 340 average. He only had one home run, but he also only had 54 plate appearances, right? It's like he was doing fine. He even stole three bases in those 54 plate appearances. Like, he was doing everything you want just in such a small sample that I don't know how to extrapolate it. And so I think the reality is Story is a guy that my hope is, as a fantasy manager, that everybody is like, he was hurt, he struggled. Yeah, he got hot at the end, but it wasn't long enough. I don't buy it. And his value plummets. I'm hoping that happens, because unlike where I sort of landed with Bryant, I think I want Story next year. I think I want him on my teams.
Yeah, I mean, I just have a natural bias where I don't like drafting any Red Sox. But if he was wearing any other jersey, then I'd be like, yeah, I want him too. I think part of the reason why he's on this list of players that are hard to evaluate, it's not as simple as like former superstar who only played 96 games, so what do we do? It's more like former superstar who, new location, huge contract, and basically had three or four different seasons this year, right? He had the incredibly disappointing start. Then he had a May where he hit 9 home runs. He's hitting a home run like every single day,
yeah,
but also hit 230. And then he was hurt a ton. Then he tore it up, and now he's hurt again. I don't know how much of the prolonged absence here at the end is the Red Sox sort of saying, like, this guy's had a tumultuous season, and we're not going anywhere. We're spinning tires, so let's just rest him up. I'm kind of with you. I guess the one thing that kind of sticks out for me is, if you pace out his season to like 150 games, he could have got 30-20. But that 20, how significant is that going to be next year if stolen bases across the board are kind of up? But I don't think there's any way we could really evaluate that between now and the start of next season. So I'm not sure how much that is going to matter. What might actually matter is the fact that he was not caught stealing once. He was extremely efficient on the base paths. He looked great. He's quick, athletic. So I think if the Red Sox are willing to let him run,
stolen bases without being caught.
Yeah, he was awesome. So that could actually go up next year, and we could be talking about a sneaky 30-30 threat for a discount. So there's my Red Sox bias for you, Trevor Story, 30-30 next year.
I don't know if I'm counting on 30-30, but I'm with you. I think he's going to have a good year.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll see with Story, but let's keep the list moving. Let's do one more before we take our break. And this guy is, oh man, this is a tumultuous player every year, Chad. Jack Flaherty. What are we doing with Jack Flaherty for 2023?
I guess just accepting that he's tumultuous every year and moving on. I don't know. I was all over him this year. I really like, he is so talented. And, you know, he had that, like, if you go back and look at his career, like, talk about tumultuous, you know, 2017, he comes up as a 21-year-old rookie, he gets 5 starts, 21 and a third innings, one relief appearance as well. And he was awful. He walked everybody, he was homer prone, but he was 21 and just figuring things out fine. Comes back in 2018 and 2019 and is good in 2018 and great in 2019. He puts up 151 and then 196.1 innings, like, everything you want to see from a 22, 23-year-old growing into his role. Then in 2020, we have the weird shortened season. He only makes 9 starts and throws 40 innings, which is, you know, almost a full season for 60 games, right? It's not quite a full starter slate. Some guys are going 12, 13, but it's close enough. But his performance wasn't good. His walks jumped. His strikeouts went down and his walks went up is part of it. And his BABIP went up. So the thing that you sort of notice when you look at that season is he had a 281 BABIP. The 2 years before, when he'd been so good, were 257 and 242. And then he only made 15 starts, 17 appearances, 78 innings in 2021, but again was very good. But again, it's a 233 BABIP. And then this year has just been bad. Like, he's barely pitched. He's only made 7 starts. He made 3 starts in June. He was hurt. He came back, made 3 starts in June, got hurt again, and has now made 4 starts in September. And, like, there's not even really clear progress or progression. He was bad in his June starts. He's been bad in his September starts. The BABIP is like 300, which doesn't seem crazy, except that when he's been good, it's been in the 230s, 240s, 250s. The last couple years, and even before that, the zone percentage on his four-seamer was in the mid-50s, which doesn't seem crazy high, right? 54%, 55.6%. It's down to 50% this year. Major league average is 50.4%. So he's gone from you know, just above average, you know, decent amount above average, something above average to a little tiny bit below average, basically average. His O swing on his four swing on his four seamer, which has never been super high, is well below league average, and that seems concerning. His slider O swing, and that should be a pitch that gets a lot of chases, is down, as is his own percentage on that. His curveball O swing is down, as is his own percentage on that. Like, he does not have a pitch this year, as far as I can tell, that is above average on zone percentage or above average on O swing. So it's really, really hard to get strikes consistently if you don't have a pitch you can throw for strikes, and if you don't have a pitch you can get people to chase. And he really has neither this year. Now, he's been hurt, and I don't know how much of that is just injury related, how much of this is him just working his way back. Like, control does take time to regain, but that is, like, I don't see the pieces that I want to see coming together. And that's concerning, right? Like, you know, when I look at a guy like Flaherty, what I'd like to see is the pieces are all there. He just hasn't sort of made it all work. And it's, you know, he just needs to get himself a little bit, shake off some of the rust, we'll say, right? He needs to just shake off some of the rust. But, like, I don't know. I don't see it. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe he brings those zone percentages back up. And when those come back up, guys have to swing more, and that causes them to chase more. And the O swing, like, you can see a cascade that theoretically could happen, but it's not happening. And so I don't know. I have a hard time trusting that it's going to get better. And when I say it's not happening, like, his zone percentage overall, right? It's like, actually, let's look at just his four seamer. His zone percentage on his four seamer has only in his last start finally come back up to 55%. His zone percentage on his slider was his lowest in his last start. Like, his last start was his lowest zone percentage. On his curveball, his zone percentage was sort of around his season average in his last start. There's no real progress there. Like, so maybe that four-seamer coming back up in his last start is a sign of something. When I first looked at this, he had been trending down with that, and it's starting to maybe come back up. But, like, there's just such limited data that tells me things are headed the right direction that I don't know. You know, he should get at least one more start, maybe two more starts, and maybe in those starts he starts to show what I'm looking for. But if not, I don't know. I'm not going to have him as often as I did this year, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's excellent analysis. And Flaherty, to me, is a guy who has been incredibly overrated. You brought up the pitch usage, and this was something that Paul Sporer of Fangraphs and Sleeper in the Bus was pushing a lot, even after that 2019 season, where Flaherty really relies on two pitches, right? I mean, the sinker and curveball he's tried out as his third pitches, and they just haven't panned out as reliable strike throwing pitches. And as he pointed out, really, his other two pitches aren't all that reliable when it comes to throwing strikes, which makes life difficult. And I feel like his fantasy value has been hoisted up by a really hot debut, which caught people's attention and put him in the news. And then a second half of 2019, where, I don't know if you remember that second half of 2019, but, like, him and Yu Darvish became like Sandy Koufax and Pedro Martinez for that. Absolutely insane. Like, he pitched over 90 innings and had an ERA under two or under one. I think it was under one in the second half. And, like, we just keep holding out hope that that's going to somehow repeat itself. And I know the COVID year was tough, not just for Flaherty, but for the Cardinals in general. But here are his innings totals the last three years. 29 innings this year, which will go up to maybe it gets to 45.
Mm-hmm.
78.1 in 2021 and 40.1 in 2020. So even if you're a Flaherty stan, even if you're a Flaherty fan, what is the realistic expectation that he even hits 130 innings next year? Like, I have not bought into the hype in Flaherty in years. In the more years that he churns out with injuries and disappointments and a lack of control all of a sudden, like, it's going to be really hard for me to jump back on board. And earlier you brought up the BABIP, and I actually think I think Cardinals pitchers can continue to support low BABIPs, but will that be affected now with the departure of Harrison Bader in center field? I don't know. So, you know, that could begin to go up a little bit. I think Flaherty is talented. He's still young enough. He could develop a third pitch. He could become an ace. But even if everything goes well, I guess this is my point. If we're talking 2023, what is a realistic expectation? Because he's not going to go out there and throw 170 innings, 180 innings and compete for a Cy Young. It's not happening.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's the problem. So I'm just, yeah. I'll end up being staying away from him. I overdrafted him this year and I have regrets.
So, dude, in the keeper cut hot new league, I don't know if you remember, I was like, I'm going full Chad here. I'm taking two pitchers that I like, and then I'm just going to get a bunch of like guys for cheap. And the cheap guys were Tristan McKenzie, Christian Javier, like guys I really like. Tony Gonsolin was one of them. But then the two aces that I relied on were Lucas Giolito and Jack Flaherty. So that did not go to plan there. Maybe that's why I'm so upset with Flaherty.
Yeah, maybe we should just talk about Giolito right now.
Yeah, that's a good transition. But before we do, we should take a break. So please take a second to listen to our sponsor. We'll be right back.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
Welcome back, everyone. We're going over my two massive mistakes from the Keeper Cut Otnew Listener League. We just talked about Jack Flaherty. Now we're going to talk about somebody who arguably had a worse season, because at least Flaherty had an excuse. I think Lucas Giolito is still sporting an ERA over 5. But maybe, he's come back around a little bit lately. So, Chad, what are your thoughts on Lucas Giolito as we head into next season?
Yeah. I think he definitely hurt you more than Flaherty did, if only because you probably started him like 20 times instead of the maybe, like, I don't know, Flaherty. If you drafted Flaherty high, there's a reasonable chance that you drafted him and just bailed right away. And like, that sucks. You know, you lose that draft pick basically, but at least the damage is over at that point. With Giolito, you use that draft pick and then you probably just kept throwing him out there for a while before you finally decided, you know what, this isn't going to work. Giolito. So I did not have Giolito on a single roster this year. And I would love to be able to say, like, look at this brilliant offseason analysis I did. I figured out that he was going to break. No, I just don't like him. I don't think I've never been a huge fan of his for any number of reasons. And I think I felt like he always got overdrafted. And so it wasn't so much that I thought like, oh, he's going to fall apart. It was more just like, I never really believed he'd consistently be an ace. And so when people are drafting him as an ace, he just was never there for me. So I never took him. You know, looking at him this year, like, his K rate is down, his walk rate is up, his home run per fly ball rate is up, but so is his ground ball rate. And so his home runs are relatively flat to last year. The biggest difference between this year and last year for Giolito is last year he had a 269 BABIP. The year before it was 255, for what it's worth. He has a 352 BABIP this year. Now, on the one hand, I can't imagine that continues. On the other, the White Sox don't field the ball. Like, they're really, part of this is sort of going off of my personal experience, having watched them quite a bit as a Guardians fan. And like, I think it was the first inning that the Guardians and White Sox played this year, the White Sox made three errors. just awful, bad errors, and it really never seemed to get better. And so now I feel like I should probably at least go do some quick research here. And so I'm pulling up now outs above average by team. And the White Sox are, in fact, the seventh worst defensive team by outs above average in baseball. There are only eight teams with an outs above average of negative 10 or worse. And most of those teams are just bad teams that weren't trying. And then you've got the White Sox and Twins. The Phillies, too, but I think everyone knew they were going to be bad defensively. But like the White Sox and Twins have been really bad defensively. And those are, despite how badly they've collapsed, those are definitely decent teams. So when you look at that BABIP number for Giolito, it is tempting to say, you know, oh, he's for his career, he's got a 280 BABIP. It's going to come way back down. And I do think it'll come back down from 352, but I don't think it's going to be low. That is a bad defensive team. And like in some ways, they may get worse next year because over the last month or so, they replaced Tim Anderson at shortstop with Elvis Andrus. And Andrus is a good defender. Like Andrus has been a one outs above average player, but in somewhat limited time this year. Anderson was a negative two. I mean, you look at like where could the White Sox improve their defense next year? Like, I'm not really sure how that happens. Anderson's going to be back. They're still going to have this like Eloy Jimenez, Andrew Vaughn. Like, these guys still have to be on the field somewhere. You know, maybe they move on from Jose Abreu, and then because I think he's a free agent this year. And that puts Vaughn at first base and then, you know, opens up DH. And like, but yeah, he is a free agent. So maybe they're done with Abreu and that makes room for someone else to play first base and like things sort of cascade from there. Oscar Colas, who's tearing up AAA since a recent call up, could be their opening day right fielder and he should be a defensive improvement. Like Luis Robert being healthy for the whole season would make a big difference. But I think he's just like he's got bad defense behind him, and I think he's still going to have bad defense behind him next year. And so I see a bounce back from Giolito, but I don't like he's not going to repeat what he did the last couple of years. He's going to be a high threes ERA, is my guess.
Yeah, honestly, in high threes, I hate to say this because I actually really like Giolito, but high threes might be a little bit optimistic. I think the big thing there is not necessarily Abreu or Anderson or whatever they decide to do at those spots. It's what you mentioned with Vaughn and Eloy Jimenez and really that outfield as a whole, because Giolito is a real fly ball pitcher. He's a fly ball pitcher to a T. He does not have an impressive ground ball rate at all. A lot of balls in the air, which makes him just a terrible candidate for the Ottnew League that I grabbed him in. I clearly underestimated the home runs per nine category, but that's kind of besides the point. It helps explain, like, I think people might be surprised to hear that Lucas Giolito has a lower XFIP this year than he did last year. Like going into this year, he was being drafted as a top 20 starter, or like around four through six kind of guy, if I remember correctly. And he ended up posting an even better expected FIP. But again, that's accounting for a league average home run to fly ball rate, which like Giolito's just never going to have. So many balls go in the air for him. And they're hit hard. He does not have an impressive average exit velocity against. Like they're going to carry and they're going to go out at whatever White Sox Stadium is called. I feel like they've changed names a few times.
Is it guaranteed rate now? I think it's guaranteed.
Is it still that? Oh, okay. But either way, like the other big thing for Lucas Giolito that makes me really hesitant is the dip in strikeout rate that he's had. That strikeout rate has fallen like each year since his like peak a couple of years ago. Granted, it's only a few years of sample size, but it's gone down from, it was 33.7 in 2020 in the shortened 2020, and it was 32.3 the year before. That's an absolutely elite strikeout rate, 28% last year and down to 25.7% this year. So do the math. Like he's going to have a high BABIP. If there's bad fielding behind him and he's putting a lot of balls in play, that are hit on average pretty hard, like that's going to result in a high BABIP. So like you can look and say like, all right, all four of his pitches underperformed their expected batting average. Like all of them had a higher batting average against than what was expected. But like for players like Giolito, that actually kind of makes sense considering expected batting average. A lot of that is exit velocity and launch angle. So I'm with you. I'm not excited about Giolito heading into 2023. He's got a lot to fix.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, speaking to that strikeout rate, one thing to note is 2019, 2020, his fastball velocity and his four seamer was 93.9, then 94, pretty steady. It dropped to just 93.8 last year. So just a small drop off from where it was. But I'm not even sure that counts as a drop off, right? 93.9, 94, 93.8, all basically the same. 92.7 this year. That's a meaningful drop. And if that's, you know, the big worry is that that's the start of a trend, right? If he's all of a sudden at 92 or 91.5 or something next year, like there are guys who can learn to pitch at a different level, but they have to learn to pitch at a different level. And I'm not sure we've seen Giolito show us that yet. So yeah, I was out this year anyways, and maybe not for good reason, but he certainly didn't, you know, turn that around for me.
And like, I understand people kind of rolling their eyes at this, and we're not doctors, but for a 27-year-old to have a pretty significant dip in velocity, like, I don't think he's out of the woods for a potential injury there. Would you be surprised at all if he has, you know, arthroscopic elbow surgery to remove chips this offseason or something like that? I would not be surprised.
Interestingly, in some ways, that might make me feel better. I mean, obviously, like, if he has Tommy John or whatever, like, something bad happens, yeah, he's being shut down, whatever. But like, if the White Sox announce in like 2 weeks, forget 2 weeks, they could announce tomorrow that Giolito is being shut down to have some cleanup done on his shoulder or elbow and blah, blah, blah. And like, you know, he could have pitched through it, but their season's over. So why not give him a chance to get right? Like that might actually increase my interest in him for next year, because at least it would give me some reason to believe that he could turn things around. If they don't announce something like that, if there's not an injury, then it's just velocity loss and it's just poor performance. And I don't know. By the way, you were talking about his value. His ADP was 44, and his average auto new value is, his median auto new price is $21. So he's being paid, you know, not as necessarily an ace in auto new or really in NFBC, but that's a pretty high price for a pitcher.
Well, I have him at 20, and with home runs per nine, that's the category, right? Home runs per nine.
Yeah.
I'm not. Yeah. Okay, yeah. With that being a category, there's no chance that I'm not cutting him at $20. Going to be 22. Last thing I want to say about that is, like, this is totally anecdotal and unfair, but I agree with you when it comes to hitters, when like an injury comes out and it's like, this could explain it. But like we just saw with Shane Baz, who just like completely rocked my season this year because I had him in so many spots. He had that arthroscopic elbow surgery to clean up bone chips. And it was like, yeah, he'll be back soon. And that kept getting kicked down the line. He comes back, looks all right, gets out again. And now we found out he needs Tommy John. It's those off-season injuries for pitchers where, like, if it's anything to do with the arm, I'm out. So it's a no-win situation for Giolito, in my eyes, anyway. On to the next name here. I'm going to let you choose, Chad, because one, we have a pitcher who switched teams this year who is like hurt. And I like the pitcher. I'm sure he's a good guy. This is nothing against him. And it's not victory lapping injuries at all. It is going to be victory lapping performance, though, because the Yankees were too like well off. They did not need Luis Castillo. No chance were they going to give up Anthony Volpe to get Luis Castillo. And they went and got Frankie Montas instead, who's been little better than Keigawa for them. And then there's Juan Soto, who on the other extreme has not been dealing with injuries, but has had a really strange season, especially in the batting average department. So which direction do you want to go in, Chad? Another pitcher, or are we going to talk some Juan Soto?
Let's talk Soto, just because I think we can talk quickly about Soto, because I'm of two minds on him. One is in drafts like NFBC type stuff, especially in 5x5. I just think he was like, I didn't have him in any 5x5 leagues because I never really bought into him as a top 4 pick or whatever he was going as. Like his ADP was like third. And the reason is, you know, he wasn't going to get to double digit steals. He probably wasn't going to get to 30 home runs. Well, he's still got a shot at 30 home runs, but like he had 29 home runs last year. He's only gotten to 30 home runs once in his career. And so, yes, you expect him to give you a high average, but average is a very fickle statistic. It always is. Even for the best high average hitters, it's hard to bank on. And he was playing on a terrible team that wasn't going to score much. So like I was always a little bit sort of, I don't know. He wasn't my choice for a top five pick. In auto new leagues, I was more than happy to pay up for him. On-base percentage is not fickle, and it really, I mean, it depends how you want to look at it, right? His on-base percentage the last 2 years was 490 and 465. So by that token, a 404 this year looks bad, but you're still very happy with 404 on-base percentage. I don't know. I have no worries, like literally none. His strikeout rate is down from the last 2 years. His walk rate is a little bit down from last year, but basically where it was. His BABIP is way down. His line drive rate is down, but line drive rate is the kind of thing that can move around a bit. Like I'm more interested in the fact that he was actually hitting more fly balls, which for a guy who hits the ball as hard as he does should lead to more power. His exit velocity was down a bit, but his barrel rate was sort of fine. He has a, you know, last year he had a 429 xWOBA, but this year it's 407. Like it's down, but not down in a like, oh no, I'm worried about this way. So I don't know. I'm completely unconcerned about Soto. I don't think he should have been sort of a top five pick. And to be fair, like I had the same issue with Vlad going as early as he was in drafts. Like I don't know. And Vlad, it was something of a position issue, but like, at least Vlad, you were thinking 45 home runs. You weren't expecting that from Soto. So like, go back and look at what Soto's done over his career. He's going to do it again. That's what it comes down to. Don't expect him to do something he hasn't done. He's not going to steal 15 bases for you. He's probably not going to steal 10. He's not going to hit 45 home runs for you. He's probably not going to hit 35. Like, that's fine. Just be aware of that. What he's going to do is get a lot of hits, get a lot of walks, be on base constantly. In that lineup, he should score a million runs and get a bunch of RBIs. And like in auto new leagues, he's gonna have a lot of singles, a lot of doubles, he's gonna have enough home runs. He's gonna be on base constantly. Like I don't know. I'm not worried about Soto. I think this year was some noise in his line drive rate and his BABIP and very little else.
Yeah. There's nothing there that I'm going to disagree with. He's eighth in WRC plus. He's fourth in expected WOBA. Like Juan Soto is a bona fide stud. It comes down to format. To me, in everything but Roto, and this includes head-to-head categories. I've talked about my strategy in head-to-head categories in the past, and I'm sorry, I don't care as much about stolen bases if you're going to be such an outlier in the other four categories, which I think Juan Soto can be. Like you said, batting average is fickle. In Roto 5x5, I think Juan Soto is easily an early-ish first round pick, right? Like, I mean, we've had the emergence of Aaron Judge here. Alvarez has burst on the scene. All these guys as first round picks, but I still think Juan Soto's right there with them. And in, you know, even in standard Roto, I still think he's probably a late first round, maybe early second round if you're worried about the stolen bases. I do think though he could be the type that benefits from the bases being a little bit bigger. Again, so much of stolen bases comes down to intent, and because he's just on base so much, like he might not have the speed of some of these other base dealers or even the intent of some of them, but if he's on base as much as he is and now the bases are a little bit bigger, okay, well maybe he goes from being a 6 stolen base guy to a 10 stolen base guy, and that is not nothing. By the way, Vlad Guerrero 8 stolen bases this year, which is just, I don't know what's going on there. You brought him up and made me think about it. So Juan Soto, I'm with you. He's a stud. If you're in a league with you know, 9 or 11 other people that don't think Juan Soto is a stud, congratulations, because you're going to win next year. All right. So then let's flip to actually another outfielder. We'll circle back to Frankie Montas, but on the subject of outfielders, Nick Castellanos is someone who, man, this guy has really had an up and down career in terms of especially power production. So what'd you see from Castellanos this year and going into next year? What are we doing with him?
So I think the most confusing thing to me is Castellanos has been like he has had his best performances in Great American Ballpark. Like very specifically at that ballpark. It's not just like a home road thing. It's just like he's been really good there. And I mean, like if I pull up his, I'm going to pull up career numbers right now. His career numbers for that ballpark. So for his career at Great American Ballpark, he has a 315 average, a 371 on base, 644 slugging, a 157 WRC plus. I mean, he's just been excellent there. Castellanos, going back, looking again at it, he had a 315 average at Great American Ballpark. At all other ballparks, it's 273. His on-base percentage at Great American Ballpark is 371. At all other ballparks, it's 322. His slugging percentage at Great American Ballpark is 644. At all other ballparks, it's 459. It's like, that's a pretty significant difference. And now part of that you could say is like, well, he got better after his years in Detroit. Okay, that's fine. So let's just focus on, you know, 2019 to the present. And he has a 324 BABIP at Great American Ballpark, not BABIP, 324 average at Great American Ballpark and a 269 average in all other parks. In all other parks, he has a 317 OBP. In Great American, he has a 380. Like I can keep going with this. 163 WRC plus at Great American, 104 at all other ballparks. But like he has been much, much better in that one stadium than he has anywhere else. And I don't know. I mean, maybe that's, you know, we know it's a hitter's park. I was worried about that going into his free agency. And then he landed in Philly and I was like, that park won't hurt him. He'll be fine. And so I'm not really sure what to make of it other than like, is he actually like perfectly built for one stadium? It seems sort of crazy to think, but like that's almost where the numbers lead me. Now I'm not, it doesn't really make sense to think that like, oh boy, if he just got traded back to the Reds, he'd be great at home and terrible on the road like he had been. But I don't know. I have no idea what else to make of this. It's like, he turned back into his like early career Detroit self. Low on base, no power. I don't get it. I don't get it at all. And I'm not really sure how to describe what happened to him. Like even things like his walk rate this year is down. That's obviously part of it. But his strikeout rate this year is right around his career numbers. They're right where they were in 2020. Wasn't very good, I guess, actually. His BAPIP is fine. 327 BAPIP. Like he's a career 330 BAPIP. He's a high BAPIP guy and he's still that. I just don't know what it is. It's like he looks sort of the same. His hard hit rate is down and his barrel rate is down. Maybe that's what it comes down to. Like maybe that's the big difference, is he's not hitting the ball as hard. It's just a very strange phenomenon where a lot of his overall numbers in terms of the stuff you expect to influence his final performance look fine, and then his final performance is terrible. And the only big change is that he changed parks, and now he's not hitting the ball as hard again. I don't know what to make of that.
It's bizarre. I thought maybe, you know, I was wondering, well, maybe Schwarber in that outfield is forcing him to play the field more, but he's actually DH'd more this year than he has the past 2 years. Like he's pretty much always been in the outfield. I think the big thing for Castellanos has been the ball. Now, this is a theory that I think was come up with by Chris Towers at CBS. And essentially these line drive gap to gap guys are the ones that were going to be most affected by the deadened ball. I don't know if there's been a follow-up article on that, if there's been enough evidence to suggest it, but I do know that Castellanos before the season, or I should say when the season started and we started seeing the effects of this ball, was kind of targeted as like this could really impact guys like him more than others. And I mean, I guess in theory it makes a little bit more sense than just some magical ballpark, as helpful as Great American Ballpark is, but until we get more data on it, you know, I don't know that there's much more to be said there. He's never been a super powerful hitter, despite the monstrous power seasons at Great American Ballpark. He's by definition a line drive hitter. And yet, even with that, has still managed to disappoint this year. So I don't know. It depends on where he's batting in the lineup. But if he's still a 20 homer, 90 RBI with a safe floor for batting average, if we can just kind of like say this was a weird season and that's what he's going to be going forward, I still like him. But the days of 30 homer Nick Castellanos seem far behind us.
No, I think that's right. And I think the concern I have is batting average. Like we said, batting average is fickle. And so like he seems like a safe batting average guy, but I hate banking on it. So,
right.
What I really want to see is his walk rate come back up. And, you know, part of his walk rate being down is that his zone percentage is up. And that may be because guys are challenging him more, but he's also, his O swing is up and his Z swing is down. Like that is not a great combination. And so he's swinging at fewer strikes and more balls and getting more pitches in the zone. Like that is going to lead to fewer walks, and he needs to correct at least the parts of that he can control and bring his walk rate back up a bit for me to really feel good about him. I don't know how I, you know, see that happening. Like we're not going to know, right? By draft season, you're going to have to just make a bet on that. But that's what I want to see early in the year from him. He's definitely, I had him in a bunch of places this year. His value has definitely dropped for me. I'm sure I won't be the low man on him. And what I just don't know is, you know, what you just said is probably a reasonable expectation for him. And I just don't know if that's where the consensus will land, or if people are going to be like, oh, he stinks, he was awful. If people are thinking that, I'll probably end up with him in a bunch of places. If there's, you know, a couple people in each of my leagues willing to be like, I'm just going to ignore last year, he's still the guy I thought he was, then I probably won't end up with him anywhere.
Yeah, I think I'm going to end up being in the same camp. Last thing I'll say on Nick Castellanos is, if you're looking for signs of a decline while you're speaking, this kind of caught my attention. I'd hesitate to rely really on expected batting average, but one of the places I look to see like if a hitter is declining is how they do against fastballs. And although Castellanos had a 300 batting average against on fastballs this year, which is obviously very good, since 2016, this is a huge sample. His expected batting average against fastballs in 2016 was 333. In 2017 was 328. 2018, 326. 2019, 338. 2020, 329. Last year, 339 expected batting average against fastballs. This year, that's down to 282. So if he's all of a sudden he's past that 30-year-old threshold and he's struggling with fastballs a little bit more, then we could continue to see that trend going forward. And that would be a concern for me as well. All right. So I said we talk about Frankie Montas. I feel like I've now all of a sudden turned this into the Frankie Montas episode where I hype him after every single player. So let's chat Frankie Montas pretty quickly. Any thoughts on Montas going into next year? He was so good for most of this year.
I know. And I had one of my bold predictions this year for Otto New was that Montas would be the highest scoring pitcher in Otto New. And, you know, bold prediction. I obviously, you know, knew it was out there, but clearly is not. It's not worked out very well. But yeah, I mean, he had a 3.18 ERA with Oakland and was striking out over a quarter of the hitters he faced, walking just 6.6% of hitters, then went to New York. And in just under 40 innings, his ERA is 6.35. His walk rate dropped from 25.8% to 17.8%. Sorry, his strikeout rate dropped from 25.8% to 17.8%. His walk rate rose from 6.6% to 8.1%. And so like that combination, like strikeout rate minus walk rate has been shown to be a very valuable predictor of performance. He had a 19.1 strikeout rate minus walk rate with Oakland, and it is down to 9.7 with New York. And so, everything has gone wrong for him. His ground ball rate has dropped, although not a ton. But interestingly, like his hard hit rate is actually lower with New York. His barrel rate is actually lower with New York. So like, I don't really know what to make of that exactly. Seems very strange, but the issue really seems to be a lot more balls in play because he's not striking anyone out, and a lot more guys on base because he's walking way too many. And his velocity didn't really change. And so yes, he's been hurt, but it doesn't feel like it's not obvious to me. Like if his velocity was also down a mile per hour with New York, then you start to look at this and be like, okay, he got hurt right away. He was trying to pitch through it because all of a sudden he was in a pennant race. And I get that, But I don't think that's what happened. I think he just was worse. I think he just pitched worse with the Yankees than he did with Oakland. And like, maybe he was pitching scared because of the park, right? He went from a place where like he could just do what he wanted to do. And if the ball was put in play, so be it. And maybe at New York, he got more concerned about that. And as a result, wasn't as effective, but like, I don't know. There's nothing in here that I can point to say like, this is why he's walking too many guys, or this is why he's not striking out as many guys, because I don't see that drop in velocity. I don't see his zone rate, for example, went from 39% to 38.1%. It's down, but it's not down a ton. His swing rate, guys are being more patient against him. So his overall swing rate is down 2%. It's down about 2% in O-swing and about 4% in Z-swing. Like, maybe it's just guys laying off better, but like, why would guys suddenly start laying off better when he gets to New York? Like, that feels like it's probably just randomness in the data. And so I don't know. I feel like he should be the same guy. A lot of the underlying things make him look to me like the same guy, but the results are drastically different. I just don't know what to make of that. And I have to dig in deeper. Like, maybe he changed his pitch mix because maybe New York wants him to do something different. And maybe they actually like messed him up. Maybe he just lost his feel for his splitter, which is, you know, his bread and butter. And when it's not working, it like, maybe that's all it is. But man, I feel like there's this handful of pitchers who like go to New York and all of a sudden, like, you know, Sonny Gray is sort of the poster child for this. Like, they can't pitch in New York, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I've never been a big one to buy into this, like, oh, they can't handle the pressure in New York. But like, maybe that's part of it here. Maybe like suddenly being thrust into a pennant race in the biggest media market in the world was just a little much.
Especially when you
cover that in the offseason.
Especially when you consider where he was coming from. I mean, he's going from a place that more people attend high school baseball games than were attending Oakland A's games. So it's not like he was going from, like, you know, all right, he's coming from Milwaukee and now he's going to New York. No, like, he was playing in front of nobody and then playing in front of everybody. I can't really make a judgment on Frankie Montas until we figure out what's going on with the shoulder, right? He missed a couple of games. Right at the end of August there, whatever it was. Maybe it was going to the All-Star break. I can't remember. And then he comes back, looks bad, and now he's out again. So once we get more clarity on that, I'll be more interested. And you brought up the splitter. I'd have to look at the numbers, but that's the hardest pitch to rely on, right? I mean,
right.
It looks like Kevin Gausman's finally like figured it out, but I always go back to Tanaka. It was like Tanaka either looked like a Cy Young or one of the worst pitchers in baseball, and it all depended on that pitch. That's a little harsh on Tanaka. I thought he was incredible. But if he didn't have that splitter working, then yikes. So Chad, do you want to do one more of these names or do you want to try to do all of them in like a rapid fire round?
I feel like there's so many names on this list, we could do a whole other episode like this. And so maybe we just hold off and go over more of them next week or something. But
that works for me.
I do think we could do a quick rapid fire on three guys. Maybe there's more. I'm trying to think if there's any others that are the other direction, right? Almost all the guys we've talked about, not almost all the guys we've talked about. We've talked about seven players here and every single one of them was disappointing either in their performance or the amount of time they played or both. But let's throw out some names and I'm going to take over here and throw them at you instead of you throwing them at me. Ha ha ha. And I want to know, are you buying into this like excellent, excellent performance we got from these guys? The first one looks like he might be an MVP candidate, and that's Paul Goldschmidt.
Yeah, he's going to win the MVP. When you talk about fantasy value, I can't think of someone who's had like such large movements as Paul Goldschmidt, where Scott White at CBS came out with an article yesterday that's definitely worth reading. He does this every year, which is predicting the first two rounds next year. And he has Paul Goldschmidt as like a mid-second round pick. And you can't disagree with it. Of course, that's like around where he's going to go. But like, how much are we willing to now like buy back in on a player who's going to be 36 years old and putting forward, like, I don't want to say career seasons, because he has had an amazing career. And I think the people that like sold out on him, you kind of look silly now. Like, what were you thinking? It's Paul Goldschmidt. Okay, he goes to the Cardinals and has a little bit of a hard time adjusting, but it's Paul Goldschmidt. So that's kind of like my way of not answering your question of, I don't know if I'm willing to spend a mid second round pick on a first baseman who's coming off like career seasons here.
Which first baseman are you taking before him? Who are the first basemen who go before him for you?
Definitely Freddie Freeman. I was just wrong on Freeman. I was ready to put Freeman beneath Vlad, and I don't think I'm going to do that anymore. It depends on, I think it's going to depend on format. If it's head-to-head categories, I think I'm still going to take Vlad before I take Goldschmidt, because I don't want to pay for what he did this year. I want to pay for what's going forward, and Vlad is a rising star in a great lineup. I would expect Vlad to have more runs plus RBI than Paul Goldschmidt next year, possibly home runs as well. I don't know how much I can rely on a 36-year-old to steal double-digit bases, though. So I guess
Goldie's not going to get to double digits this year. Goldie's got six stolen bases this year. He had 12 last year.
That makes it even easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes it even easier. So
what about,
I know this is supposed to be rapid fire.
What about Pete Alonso? Right. Alonso, this year, Alonso was the third or fourth guy off the board at first base, right? It was Freeman and Vlad, and then a lot, or not in that order, Vlad and then Freeman, really. And then you had Alonso and Olson, who we talked a lot about in the preseason.
Yeah.
Goldie's obviously been better than them. You taking Alonso before Goldschmidt?
Honestly, I think I am. I don't think it's going to go that way in drafts, but I think I would. Alonso's proven he's going to have this stigma as like a strikeout, low batting average guy. He's just not. Like, we talked about this in the past. He's not a strikeout player. He's got a good strikeout rate. Yeah, you don't want to pay for what they did the year before. You want to pay for what they're going to do going forward.
Yeah, I think my answer for that one is that I will. It's not that I would take Alonso before Goldie, but I think I would wait on Alonso rather than taking Goldie. Right. I think there will be an opportunity.
Like, if it's a 12-team league, you might not be like, I think those two are going to be so closely ranked. Like, I could see Alonso being a early third rounder and Goldschmidt a mid to late second rounder, where like you might just have to make a call if you want to go first base there.
You might. But I think that's an interesting idea where, like, if you are, you know, let's say you got the third, fourth pick in the draft, 12-teamer, and you come around and they're both on the board with your second round pick. I think I would pass on Goldschmidt there. And if Alonso falls to me, take him. And if he doesn't, then I'll find a first baseman later. I mean, like the number five first baseman on the Razzball player rater this year is CJ Krohn. Number six is Christian Walker. Number seven, let's talk about number seven real quick, because he's another name. Are you buying it or not? Nate Lowe.
Your boy. First of all, I agree with what you just said. I think we're going to have actually really similar approaches next year based on this conversation today, where like, if they're both available, I'll just see if I can get Alonso in the next round. If he's taken, okay, I won't fill first base in the first three rounds, twist my arm. Nate Lowe, it's just been a monstrous second half. So like, he's still really young. I love that he's a lefty who hits lefties really well, because I don't have to worry about play time and I can get excited about that. And I do think the Rangers are on the rise. So it's a cop-out, but it depends on where the ADP is, because I'm not going to overpay for Nate Lowe. I don't think he's shown enough in his career for me to overpay, but I do think he could be a solid source of homers, RBI, in a better batting average floor than we might think.
You taking him as a top 10 first baseman next year?
I'd have to look, but honestly, off the top of my head, no.
I mean, looking at this, Goldie, Freeman, Alonso, Vlad are all before him for sure. Despite Olson. This year, I still take Matt Olson over him.
Yeah.
And then you get into a group of like, this year, Christian Walker and CJ Krohn are going to finish ahead of him. Brandon Drury's right behind him. Jose Abreu, Anthony Rizzo, Rowdy Tellez. You know, Josh Bell will be first base only next year, but he's down at 18th on the first base rankings right now. I don't know. I think I take Lowe as a top 10 first baseman. I don't think I see an obvious 10 that go before him. Like I said, Goldie, Freeman, Alonso, Vlad, Olson. And then if I'm choosing between him and Krohn or Walker or Abreu or Rizzo or Hoskins or Rowdy, like, I might take some of those guys. I'll do my offseason research and blah, blah, blah. Like, some of those guys might go before him for me, but like, all of them? I don't think all of them go before him.
Yeah, no, you make a good point naming those names, because it's all of a sudden not as deep of a position. I am curious about a few guys like will DJ LeMay, who have first base eligibility, will Andrew Vaughn, I'd have to look that up. Is Max Muncy going to have an everyday job? Because if he does, I might like him more than Nate Lowe, even after this terrible season. And one name I don't think got mentioned, I do like Rhys Hoskins more than Nate Lowe. But you're right. There's not 10 obvious names to take before Nate Lowe at the position.
Yeah. So then one last of these guys who just had a less breakout, more a resurgence. Alex Bregman had fallen on some hard times for a couple of years there. He has not quite returned to, you know, MVP caliber Alex Bregman we saw in 2019, but very, very good bounce back season for him. And that's a very, very good bounce back season that, if I'm correct, I'm going to double check this before I say it, started, it didn't start slow necessarily. He had a 128 WRC plus in March, April, and then a 109, a 107 in May, sort of a rough May. It looked like he was still sort of settling in, and now he's got a 160 in the second half. Like, he had 142 in June, and it's just been, you know, July was down to 118, but it's just been basically good since then. Are you buying in? Do you think Bregman is sort of back? Do we know who he is now?
I don't know if we completely know who he is now, because he hasn't been performing at this level for the entirety of the season, right? If he can get, it all depends. Is he a 20 homer guy, or is he a 30 homer guy? Because there's a huge, obviously a 10 homer, but a huge difference there when it comes to the counting stats. Because if he's a 30 homer and 200 runs plus RBI player with a decently, you know, fine floor batting average, because he's not going to strike out more than, I don't know, 13% of the time he gets his bat on everything. And with how much he pulls the ball in that home park, which we've been talking about with Bregman for a long time, like, he's really solid. But am I going to bank on that for next year? Again, it'll depend on where he's going, but I don't view him as like he was going in the first round a couple of years ago, and then the second round. I guess I'd probably feel more comfortable with him in like the fifth, sixth round. If I can't get him there, that's okay, because I think those categories can be replaced. If I can get him there, then yeah, I'd be pretty excited.
Yeah, I mean, he is this year on the Razzball Player Rater seventh among third basemen. So even with this resurgence, he's not a first division fantasy third baseman. And looking at the guys ahead of him, Jose Ramirez is first, Manny Machado second, Austin Riley third, Nolan Arenado fourth, Bobby Witt Jr. fifth, Rafael Devers sixth. I'm not taking Bregman over any of those guys.
No, no chance.
I look at the guys after him.
Right.
Yeah.
Over Witt in like a points format.
Yeah, that's probably fair. I mean, if I look at him like at a points per game basis in Otter-New, Machado, Riley, Arenado, Devers, Ramirez, and Bryant. Limited playing time, but Chris Bryant is ahead of him.
That's surprising.
Yeah. But there, then he's, let's leave Bryant off, because we talked about him. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He's sixth there. I don't see him going over. I'm not taking him out, paying more for him than I am for Machado, Riley, Arenado, Devers, or Ramirez in Otter-New. Now, looking after him in both of those lists, like, in, you know, an Otter-New, Witt falls much further down, and maybe you can make a case that you'd still prefer Witt because you think he's going to do whatever next year. He's going to turn a corner and be even better than he was this year. I'm not really buying into that. On the Razzball Player Rater, the guys after him are like Brandon Drury, Eugenio Suarez, Matt Chapman, Alec Bohm, Luis Arraez, Justin Turner. Like, no one's jumping out at me on this list, and I'm like, yeah. So I think it's just sort of it. He's a 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th-ish best third baseman in almost any format. And whether he's 6th because you take him before Witt or 7th because you take him after Witt is really, like, that's really the question for me. Because there's no format where I'm taking him before Ramirez, Machado, Riley, Arenado, or Devers.
Yeah, no chance.
So it's really just a question of, like, does the fact that Witt is... Like, he's a fine hitter, but he's not a great hitter. Bregman might be a great hitter, but Bregman doesn't do a lot. He just doesn't pile up the home runs and stolen bases the way Witt does. And so, like, depending on format, I could see Bregman over Witt or Witt over Bregman. I agree with that. But I think that's it. I think he's just going to, that's just what he is. He's the 6th or 7th best fantasy third baseman.
So let me throw this out to you. Are you... in your drafts next year, let's say it's Roto 5x5, which, again, Bregman, it really depends the format. Are you ready to take Gunnar Henderson ahead of him as your third baseman?
Oh, boy. That's a tough question. I think the answer is no. I am not ready to take Gunnar Henderson ahead of him. I think this is a little bit like the Alonso versus Goldie thing. I might prefer to wait on Henderson than to take Bregman, depending on what their relative costs are. So I may like him as a better value, but I do not want, I don't prefer him.
Sure. No, that makes sense. There's a lot of players that we were able to just throw at you. And I think, Chad, you're right. I think we should do a second episode looking at the next half of these players. There's no shortage of interesting names, names that we're all going to have to make decisions on relatively soon in our keeper leagues and our new formats, so on and so forth. And I'm sure between now and next week's episode, Chad, we'll come up with a couple more names that we need to add to that list. But I think that's a good time to put a pin in it. We'll talk about this more next week. As always, thanks for listening, folks. I mean, this is our last episode that's going to come out during the season. So we really appreciate you listening this year. It's been another fun year of Keeper Cut as we approach episode 100. We're just 20.
We're going to have one more now. During the season. We're going to have one more.
Yeah, but isn't it going to release?
It's a weird season. It ends on like the season ends on a Wednesday or whatever.
Oh, okay. That's right. Yeah, because of the delayed start to the season. So how about that?
So baseball. We got one more coming. Perfect. Not done yet.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, folks. Again, follow the show at Keep or Cut. Follow Chad at Chad Young. Follow me at Pete B Baseball. Give us ratings, reviews, all that good stuff. And we will see you next week.